I'll come to Big Hook. That'd be a good excuse to go visit John Canwisher, John and Joan Canwisher, right?
Well, actually, I said I'd come to Big Hook because it would be a good excuse to visit my father-in-law, who's an investigator here at the MBL for many, many years. But the Canwishers have been on my my wall for years because Joan is an artist and she has lots of...
Joan Canwisher. Stand up. Joan has done some of the iconic art for 40 years, like the iconic artwork that pen and ink drawings of around town.
Knobska Point,
takes at home.
The Eel Pond Bridge, the MBL. All of these pictures have been on our dining room wall for a long time. And so I stopped in to visit her to see if I could get a deal on some more a couple years ago. And I was struck by the community that's here. There's a generation ahead of mine that has done most of their work. And David collects smart people, and Woods Hole is a community of really smart people. And John Canwisher, who's going to speak to us tonight. I Googled, of course, and I went out there and I saw that he did a paper on histology and metabolism of frozen intertidal animals, and I read the paper. It's really cool. Like, they freeze and then they thaw, and then they freeze and then they thaw, because they
got me a job. Don't knock it.
I know, it's a great paper. And I mean, John had a long career here at Woods Hole and at MIT. He's like a double threat. He invented the scuba rebreather, so you can swim underwater and not leave bubbles. He did underwater telemetry in the days when we're talking about like some very low bit rates. He also did this biology work that started with that paper that got him the job, and involved all kinds of cool stuff, like doing work with whales, and he's an acknowledged hemoglobin expert. And I was thinking about the impact of oxygen on salt marshes and all those things, and it's sort of like he's a polymath, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say, John. And it's an honor to be able to introduce you.
Too much. Some handouts here about what I'm going to try and talk about, in case
here.
You don't understand me.
I'll hand them around.
Yeah.
You want to keep one?
No, I got some home.
Whatever.
There's a picture on the back cover that. Some people are just plain lucky, and I was one of them. You can't pick your parents, you can't pick the time you were born, and so forth. But Moby Dick, in which the person writing the story goes from Nantucket through the hole here to. I mean, from New Bedford to Nantucket and so forth. And he was so disgusted with what happened on the Pequod that he's put a pair of oars over his shoulder and he said, "I'm going to walk inland until someone asks, what are those?" Well, I went the other way. I came from the farm and went until I found a guy with a pair of oars. And literally, I went, I had a fancy degree. I could teach in a medical school, but I hated doctors and I didn't like it. And the war had freed up my thinking on things. And I went to the dentist, and there was a picture in there of the old A-boat, we call it, the Atlantis, out in the middle of the ocean and with the big waves, and they're lowering it over the side. And I said, "Jesus, you mean people get paid for doing this?" And here I am. But essentially, I'm a physicist by training, but I'm an engineer by thinker. How does this thing work? And I started out in ham radio and grinding telescope mirrors and delivering calves and all kinds of things with animals and machines and so forth. And if you want to know how something works, I did a lot with automatic gun control and stuff and with radar during the war and stuff. You take the cover off and look inside. And so when I got a job here as a biologist, I immediately have an internal point of view. I've cut up animals for their meat, for their fur, or for both. And I know the insides almost as well as the outsides. which is something that's utterly missing for my children and the next two generations and so on. You can't go to the butcher anymore and see a side of beef and so forth. It's done hidden from view someplace. And so if you do that, you get a much more simple story. In physics and chemistry, things are very neat and orderly. You know, there's F equals ma, and there's Maxwell's equations. There's a periodic table, and you learn a few rules, and they hold all over. There are 4,000 mammals, and we're one of them. We're midway, and the smallest ones are 30,000 times smaller than us, and the biggest ones, the big whales, are 3,000 times larger and so forth. And that's 100 million times. And what's regular about them? They certainly don't look alike. And there's some that run, some that swim, and some that fly. And I thought, well, there are 4,000 species, and I will get into this, and I'm going to find out that, you know, I do half a dozen species, and someone else can do a few more. And after a few years of this, I was asked to organize a course in physiology at Harvard, and that's a whole different kettle of fish for a guy who hasn't had a formal training in zoology. So I did a lot of reading and thinking and so forth, and I said, what is it that determines the energy that animals have? And, of course, it's muscles which need sugar and oxygen. Sugar is already there, so oxygen is the key element. And my life literally has been determining how oxygen gets from the inspired breath in the lungs through to the individual cells. And most people don't realize that all energy production in animals is on a cellular basis. In cells are things that are 10 microns, you know, they're less than 1,000 of an inch and you can't see them. And the number of cells is represented by the fact that there's 5 million red cells in a cubic millimeter of blood. That's 5 billion in a cubic centimeter, which is roughly a sugar cube size. So they're tiny things and so forth. And in every one of them, there's that whole DNA Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, of everything that's ever existed in that species in different forms and so forth. But there's a common element in making energy. And the currency of energy is something we call ATP. And it's sort of like we use money in our society. And where you get your money and what you do with it are two different things and so forth. And and where animals get their energy money is they burn sugar. And since the sugar is already on site, the whole problem is how do you get the oxygen there? And you not only got to get it there, you got to get it to these tiny little cells and so forth. So you end up with a very simple in concept thing, but very complicated in the way it's carried out. And the best way to get at this is to represent essentially what my own body's like, is I'm an energy typical mammal. The only thing that's unique about me is the size of my brain. But even that isn't unique because there are animals that are my size, which have a brain slightly larger, Neanderthal, for instance, and the bottlenose dolphin and so forth. But they aren't doing the kind of things I'm doing. So, what moves oxygen? Well, it's carried by hemoglobin. And so when I was set out to teach, I didn't like the textbook, so I wrote a set of notes. And the first thing you ask is, oxygen is awfully big. It weighs 68,000 molecular weight. It's carrying a little tiny oxygen. I mean, a hemoglobin is 68,000, and it's carrying a little tiny oxygen, which weighs 32. It carries four oxygens, which is 4 times 32 is 128. So essentially, a loaded hemoglobin molecule is only 1/500th oxygen. But you can't rattle protein molecules along a thing, so you got to put them in red cells and dissolve them in liquid and so forth to make something that you can pump. And so by the time you end up with blood in mammals or birds, it's less than 1,000th part oxygen by weight. So literally, we have to distribute a ton of blood to get a pound of oxygen delivered. And it's too bad because we need the properties of hemoglobin and there's no other way around it. And so we're stuck with something that's utterly inefficient. It's roughly the size if you took a grapefruit and stuck four peanuts on the surface. It essentially represents a hemoglobin. And if you wanted to deliver peanuts, a stream of grapefruit would be a very inefficient way. I usually have a grapefruit. I didn't get one tonight. But and if you have a stream of hemoglobin, it's also utterly inefficient. Well, there's one other thing that I looked at when I started to teach is that I had been interested in how animals keep warm. And when you're dealing with a seal up on the Arctic ice, it's got two concerns. It's keeping warm and getting food. And everything else is subservient to that. So to keep warm, it has a layer of blubber. Well, blubber is not a very good insulation, but there's no other choice in the Arctic. And so half its weight is blubber. Now, to get food, it's got to dive beneath the ice and hold its breath. And its scuba tank, so to speak, is the amount of blood it has. So it has three times the blood we have. It has about 20% blood. So if we look at the seal now, we've got 50% blubber, 20% blood, and there's about 8% that's bone. And it turns out there's a little tiny animal inside this huge blob of fat. But it works, because there's 25 million of one kind of seal in the Antarctic. There's 10 million of the harbor seal in the Arctic, and so on. And so you don't want to get preconceived ideas. The only thing that an animal represents is some way of exploiting a food resource. If the food resource is under the ice, that's what it needs to do, and that's what it does, and so forth. So we get a very limited view of nature in the kind of world we move in, and in our own life, and so forth. But most of the animals are fairly normal, particularly those out of the oceans. Unfortunately, I started out here because I wanted to live in Woods Hole. And when you go out and look at mammals on the ocean, you're dealing with things which are, let's say, someone from another planet came to study American culture. If they landed in the Institute of Advanced Studies, they landed in a maximum security prison. That's roughly what you're doing when you go out in the ocean and study mammals. They bear almost no resemblance to the ones on land, except they have the same common system inside for their running their whole biological machinery. So for the first 10 years, I played around with these animals, and the first thing one wants to know is they come in all sizes. The smallest mammal is a little tiny bat that weighs a gram and a half. It's roughly the size of a bumblebee. It flies around in Thailand, you know, gathering little insects in the air and so forth. The other end, which the throwaway has a picture on the back of and so forth, is a blue whale. It weighs roughly 150 tons, which is roughly the mass of 50 elephants. And you've got to have a system that works in a wide range of species to understand mammals. And I thought, well, there can't be any uniformity in this. But when you start looking at how they move oxygen, it turns out that they are stuck by hemoglobin, and they're also stuck by how fast they can move the blood. Now, the question first about a whale is it just a normal big porpoise, or is it something special when it gets that large? And so the way to find out is you cut up a whale. And fortunately in those days, I'm an old man, and they were still whaling, and I went to a whaling station, and we cut up a whale, and it turns out its heart is the same as mine. It's 0.5% of its weight, the same as mine. Its stroke volume, in other words, the volume per contraction of the heart and so forth, is the same relative thing. Well, to a physicist, this says a lot, which biologists never notice, which is one of the things is when the muscle contracts, the amount of work it does is proportional to the volume of the muscle. You know, it's actin and myosin molecules ratcheting along each other, and we know a lot of the detailed chemistry and so forth. And once it was arrived at the beginning of vertebrates, it's never changed. And so if you have the same relative volume of muscle pumping the same relative volume of blood, you put the same relative amount of kinetic energy per unit volume into the blood that's going into the aorta, which means it's all going at the same velocity. So irrespective of whether you're a whale or a mouse, your blood moves at the same speed, which it turns out is about 35 to 40 centimeters per second, roughly a kilometer an hour. So before I did any teaching or research on these animals, I realized that we're stuck with a blood that doesn't hold much oxygen and doesn't move very fast. And all birds and mammals are caught under the same constraints. And we do as well as we can. And if we had a hemoglobin, it weighed 6,000 rather than 68,000, we could fly. So we're up against an accident, you might say a molecular accident of the past. So everything was preconditioned before we started. And so my metabolic rate, which is roughly, it turns out in numbers, is a sixth of a horsepower. And that's a bit humbling at first because, I grew up around cars, you know, and we loved horsepower. It turns out I'm a sixth of a horse. In muscle.
Which end?
We're all trying to get there quicker.
I'm curious, so.
And because I grew up around machines, I have a kind of vocabulary of machines which students like, but my colleagues don't like at all. So I've been refused publication in some of the best journals and so forth. You know. But when you start working over this stuff, it turns out that all animals, I'm talking now, when I say animals, I mean mammals and birds, have the same concentration of oxygen in the blood flowing at the same rate. And so if you make an animal that's 10 times bit longer, which means it's 1,000 times heavier, like the whale compared to me, its blood's got 10 times further to go and it takes 10 times longer. So the delivery rate is 1/10, so its metabolism is 1/10 of mine. If you go the other way to the mouse, it's 1,000th my weight and it has 10 times my metabolic rate. And so in going from the mouse to the elephant, you get roughly a 100-fold range in terms of the rate of energy used in the machinery. And you can go through, essentially I've spent my life getting details of these things and so forth, and the first impressions when I first taught in 1960 hold true for a whole thing. It took, you know, a lifetime to fill in the niches and to be really certain of it, because it seems so absurd at times that I have a hard time convincing myself, even before I convince my students. But being asked to teach really changed my life, because suddenly, instead of having a narrow little niche, you've got to be a generalist. And since I had no niche to start with, I wasn't losing anything behind. And in the shy country boy was a performer. And it turns out I took to teaching like a duck to water and loved it. And I've done it ever since. And all you have to make certain is that the student leaves with something they didn't come in with. And if I have an amphitheater of 150 students, 30 years ago they were paying $40 a lecture. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm proud of myself, but I'm not worth $6,000 an hour. So I felt a real sense of conscience that I ought to give them a good story. And so mammals, which I thought would be utterly disastrous in terms of variety and unrelatedness and so forth. I certainly don't feel any part of being a tiny bat flying in the air catching insects, or a whale searching a mile down the ocean for squid. But it turns out we all have the same way of moving oxygen, and it's all moving at the same velocity. And the only difference between size is the time the blood takes. So circulation time becomes the one index which controls essentially what metabolic rates animals have. Now, this is not very popular, and as I said, I've been refused publication in some of the best of places and so forth, but
What's the objection? Yeah. Why don't they...
Because they have a story of their own. They say there's some inner secret to the chemistry within the cell. All I'm doing is getting the oxygen to the cell, and what happens in the cell essentially is chemistry control. In every cell, there are things called mitochondria, and that's where essentially the sugar is burned and the ATP comes out to run the rest of the business of the cell, like, you know, shoving ions in and out or contracting messages along nerves and so forth. And so it's a disaster. I mean, it's an astonishingly simple story that holds for animals that vary by 100 million times in weight. And I can fill it in with any questions you want, but... the details that concerned me were unusual animals in unusual places, like the seal on the Arctic ice, or I did a lot with dolphins in the tropics, with porpoises in the Arctic, and so forth. And the same set of numbers go through the whole thing, and all you need to know is the size of the animal, the molecular weight of hemoglobin, and the diffusivity of oxygen, and the story was all decided beforehand. And this is upsetting because biologists like to think biology. And they don't get far enough away from the problem. And since I started with nothing, I had nothing to forget that wasn't probably a very solid idea. So the circulation times are rather fascinating because the little bat that weighs 1.5 grams, the blood goes around his body in about 4 or 5 seconds. We can't be exact because it's so fast. The heart's beating 1,000 times a second, a minute, and so forth. The whale, the heart's beating 5 or 6 times a minute. and it takes 15 to 18 minutes for the blood to go around the animal. And so the bat has the power per pound to fly. And the whale has this slow business of the long path, so it can hold its breath for an hour and dive a mile down in the ocean. And the only reason the two exist is there's food for them. If there's food for them, they will persist in time, they'll reproduce, and we have them to study. We are fortunate in being halfway between and also the best known species, and the only one I'm not allowed to work on. But I fuss around myself a good deal. And particularly in things like breath holding and diving and so forth. And one of the nice parts about mammals is that we are one ourselves and we know a lot about ourselves, particularly if you pay much attention. And probably the most traumatic experience of my youth was getting a life-saving merit badge in scouting and so forth. I wanted to be an Eagle Scout badly, and I was terrified of the water, and I'm still somewhat scared of it, but I spent a lot of time in it. And it's the trouble with us is we have a brain running ourselves, which is on a short-term crisis situation with oxygen. There's a couple things called carotids here. And a British admiral who's head of the diving over there, the medicine and so forth, he was a karate specialist in his student days. And he said, you run up and you touch these, you stop the blood flow of the brain, you faint in 3 seconds. And you're nothing better than a vegetable in 3 minutes. So we have a system which short-term failure is disaster. And I'm reaching the point where there's enough uncertainty in my heartbeat and so forth so that, someday it's going to stop and so forth. But it's not a complex system. It could be understood by any person in high school. And it's my mission at the end of life to put it in a form that's digestible and appreciated to let people do the right thing at the right time. Now, other animals have other sets of rules. And I did a lot of work with dolphins. And it's hard not to be emotionally involved and so forth. I mean, I didn't have to work on pretty girls, but I mean, it was almost as bad. And but the people who do good experiments on animals are ones who have a sense of feeling for them and know how to handle them. And I've been bit several times and so forth, but you know, my fingers more or less work and so forth. And my favorite colleagues are naturalists or veterinarians, because their day-to-day existence depends upon handling these animals. And I met a doctor, a veterinarian, who's in charge of the dolphins for the Navy research long ago, and he said, you know, we can do anything with these animals. I said, yeah, I've heard this before. So I said, he said, what do you want? I said, well, I want to know what happens to the gas in the lungs of a dolphin that's diving down a depth and come up and give me his breath. He said, we can do that. And I sort of forgot about this. In 6 months, he phoned up and said, it's all trained. This was on the coast of California. And what they do is they take these dolphins who quickly associate with the people in all kind of group activity and so forth. And so we lowered a sound source. We only had 400 feet of wire at the time. We have a sound source down. We turn it on to the surface. It makes a buzzing sound. They hear very well in the water. They dive down. They use their nose to turn off a button down there. Then they come up and they put their nose against another place and they breathe out and I catch their gas with a funnel.
Unbelievable.
And then if they've done right and they know they get a reward of 3 fish. Well, the first time we did this is...
So they trained you. Yeah.
Yeah, they trained me. The first time we did this is the dolphin wanted the fish before it bothered to breathe. So we later got to a depth of about 950 feet and so forth. And we found out all kinds of things is that... you know, water is very dense. Every 10 meters, every 30 feet is another atmosphere. So essentially, 900 feet is 30 atmospheres. And 30 atmospheres is a lot of pressure. And of course, the lungs are completely collapsed. And when they're collapsed, the gas is shoved up in the blowhole area. You can't see the pictures here, but I've got some pictures you can see afterwards. The dolphins.
Hold it in the light.
Essentially, you know, they breathe through this little blowhole here in about 4/10 of a second, and out several liters, in several liters, and so forth. But once they've gone any depth, essentially the lung has collapsed and the gas is saved from being used up. It's up in an area where there's no vascularization, no blood flowing, and so forth. So on the way up, they have this extra set of gas, which they, yes?
Is that how they deal with the bends?
What's
is that?
That
how they deal with the bends?
No, the bend, well, they don't get the bends because the gas is not exposed to the inert gas and so forth.
Yeah.
They do a lot of other things I can't do briefly, but the point is that a dolphin's life depends on breathing at the right time. And you can't anesthetize a dolphin because they make a conscious effort to breathe, and if you anesthetize them, they don't breathe and they die. So the only way they can you can anesthetize a dolphin is put on a forced respirator and do the breathing for them.
There's no autonomic system.
No autonomic system at all.
How do they sleep?
True consciousness.
It's very hard getting used to these rules because you're biased. Yes.
How do they sleep?
What's that?
How do they sleep?
We don't know if they do. We have a circle of Willis here, so we have one circulation for the whole brain. They divide it down the middle. They have separate brains, and they turn half the brain off. The nervous system is very expensive energy real estate. Our 2% that our brain uses roughly 20 to 25% of the energy when we're resting and so forth. And so if you want to stay underwater a long time, cut down the demands and turn off everything you can so they turn off half the brain. Birds tend to do this too, so.
Oh my God, that's what we do with silicon chips to conserve electrical power, except the dolphins figured it out first.
Yeah.
Only we can do that with the Arbok.
they turned off half the brain.
Getting back to your calculations about the oxygen and the speed with which it moves and so forth, there's this great essay that everybody, a lot of people have read about, J.B.S. Haldane's On Being the Right Size, and he introduces the scaling. And so...
it's required in my course.
It's great. Anybody who hasn't read it should read it once a year. So scale up by a factor of 10. The volume goes up by 1,000-fold. The surface area goes up 100-fold. The loss of heat is then 100 times, but your generation of heat is 1,000-fold if it were at the same speed. And what you're saying is that the rate at which you generate that goes down by a factor of 10. So all of that brings in right balance.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
That's great.
Yeah. And you get a few rules working with animals over the years is animals only do what they have to when they have to. And Dawkins has been one of the major influences in my life is that they're barely good enough to get by. And evolution by the stupid gene cannot make a judgment on this is a safety factor so we're safer. So it's just good enough. Therefore, the only way to know just good enough is to have failures. So all animals have losses all the time. Of course, with humans, it's a personal disaster, but that's what you're looking at, and various midlife crises and so forth. And getting the oxygen through the body from the lung to the rest of the body, half of our deaths come from that. So we push things to the limit. You know, we have emphysema and various... troubles with the lungs, which I'm getting now and so forth in my old age and so forth, and we have essentially all kinds of heart failures, we have burst of vessels and so forth. And of course, by working on human diving, I was pushing the system hard, and I've seen people burst their lungs in a university pool, you know, it's probably 12 feet deep, by when they're scuba training, not opening their mouth as they come up through and so forth. So, these trouble with oxygen, as I said, is it needs a hemoglobin, but it also is a very low diffusion. So our lung is roughly the size of a tennis court. It's half a micron thick, which is about a 20th the thickness of newspaper. And it's the only way, given the low diffusibility of oxygen, you can get enough to run our high energy system. And the course is, it gives you all kinds of trouble, particularly in diving.
Yeah, particularly being submerged underwater, which was not exactly evolved to do for some strange reason. That seems to be a challenge.
Well, it's, and of course, you have to get these animals and work with them. And it's been a large part of my life is, you know, and how do you handle a dolphin? I mean, a porpoise in the coast of Norway that's up by the Arctic Circle. And it turns out you give your life to it. Because if you can't handle the animal, it misbehaves behaviorally and therefore physiologically. And the original experiments were done by a man who was my god when I was young, a guy named Scholander, and he tied a dolphin on a board and he tied a seal on a board. When he put the seal underwater, his heart slowed down. It's called a diving bradycardia. When he put the porpoise underwater, its heart slowed down more. It never beat again. It died. So they disposed of that and so forth. They didn't never mention that in the papers, but essentially there's tremendous fear factor in the way you handle animals.
Why did the porpoise die?
We don't know, except it died and therefore it's probably scared to hell.
Just scared.
We don't know.
Scared to
death. Don't know. Except that you can't have lose a subject like that and not mention it in the paper. I've had a hard time dealing with these people, and one of the things we found out is that you have to have a sense of feeling for what the animal is concerned with, and this means you need some kind of facilities and so forth. So in various places in Europe, they had these big circular pools in which they tow model nets because they're studying fishing or so forth, and they make terrific porpoise tanks, and it literally made my life. But one of the things, when you put a heartbeat transmitter on them, you find out there's what I would call our physiology, the work we're doing and the oxygen our muscles need and the maintenance we need to keep our brain running and so forth. And then there are also things that, this is uncertain and I better be paying attention to this. And so essentially someone walking past the building can turn down the heart rate of one of these animals and so forth. So they're very essential to everything going on. And so it's difficult to do physiology without doing behavior. And part of my big difference from most people has been how do you manage in a practical way to do these experiments? And very few of them can be done rapidly. But for instance, when you look at the geometry, first of a seal and then of a cold water porpoise, it's Nisa, it's Fascina, if you want a name for it. But anyways, is that if you look at the amount of heat they must have for the insulation they have, our metabolic rate wouldn't do. It turns out they need 3 times the heat, otherwise they couldn't exist. And so I'm running at a certain rate, you know, when I'm sitting at my computer, more or less using a few extra fibers in my brain, essentially, I run at 100 watts, which is 250 milliliters of oxygen a minute. And I can cut off an awful lot of that. I can cut off all my gut and so forth and cut that down to about a quarter or so forth if I really needed to. Well, when it comes to a prey-predator race in which only the winner survives, you know, whether you're a predator or prey, essentially, that's essentially in the fourth decimal place. And so every little thing counts. And so their whole physiology is based upon winning those races. And fortunately, it's the same rules for both the predator and the prey. And if, I've done an awful lot of wildlife watching, and it's really what got me into this was being fascinated by movies in Africa by Martin and Osa Johnson back in the 30s. No one's probably old enough to remember them, but when you watch a lion stalking its prey, and then it just is a rushing grab, it's essentially, what we'd say in track, essentially a 220 or 440 specialist. It's going to run a quarter or a half a mile. And it's the same way with a thoroughbred horse. We've selected them now for 200 years from the same gene pool. And the fourth decimal place is what makes the winner. Mm-hmm. And so anything that makes that horse run that mile faster, and one of the things that makes it run faster is essentially a delicate framework. And so you find out thoroughbred horses have very delicate brains and they break their legs and there are tragedies all the time and so forth. So that's the single factor kind of thing. And sort of the same thing happens with the lion. The lion is 58% muscle, which is the most of any mammal.
Wow.
And the antelope is chasing has one advantage is that once it starts, it doesn't have to have the power to kill, which is a lot of the lion is essentially it's the teeth and the claws and so forth, which has got to carry the machinery along with it and so forth. The big contrast is with ourselves. We're the opposite end of the scale. We have 45 to 50% muscle. And when I teach physiology, I mean, you know, they say, well, the old guy's over the hill, you know, and so forth. So I worked hard as hell and ran a 6-minute mile on the treadmill and so on. I wasn't quite that far gone yet. But if you look at the records in this, is that They run a race called an ultramarathon, which is 100 kilometers or 60 miles. They run it in a little over 5 hours. And J.B.S. Leakey, you may know of, who found Zinjanthropus in Olduvai Gorge in Africa. And he was a friend of a friend, and when I met him, I wanted to talk about early man, and he wanted to talk about chasing game. Because of the young man, he used to chase game naked, you know, across the Sienna. And,
is that the predator-prey race?
And essentially, man can catch any animal if he puts his mind to it, and he's in reasonable training. Now, catching the animal is one thing, I mean, getting up to it is one thing, and killing it is another, and so forth. But, and it's a fascinating comparison between, say, a gorilla or a chimp, you know, and man, which is a running machine. Mm-hmm. And but they all have an amount of oxygen, and therefore an amount of energy. It's based upon their physical size and the amount of blood and the time it takes to circulate. And until you get into marine mammals, these are a given set of rules that work on the smallest and the biggest animal. And these circulation times are estimated beforehand. And so something that I thought would be utterly irregular has two numbers of which it's based upon. Molecular weight of hemoglobin and essentially the diffusivity of oxygen. So they're sort of like the F equals MA of Newtonian physics and so forth, you might say, of animal life. And what I thought was an utterly random collection of animals is one set of rules fits all. And
question. What about the non-vertebrate animals? The ones that use
oxygen. They don't all use hemoglobin.
What about ATP though? That's where is that?
I think ATP goes with them all. I'm not positive, but so forth.
So that's interesting.
But they use
the ones that if they're all using oxygen to metabolize the ATP.
Yeah, I mean, squid, for instance, use a cobalt containing a blood transfer, and earthworms use something called pyroerythrin and so forth. None of them are anywhere near as good as hemoglobin, which is not very good, but it's all we've got.
But each of these is an oxygen delivery method to metabolize.
We've got to get the oxygen.
So where do we get to the point where we're not using oxygen, like these things that are in the fumaroles in the bottom of the ocean and stuff like that?
You can run fast or slow. You can be a big or small mammal and run by a factor of about 200 difference between essentially the tiny bat and the big whale and so forth. You can also run a lot slower than that, essentially. You have fish in the Antarctic which don't have any hemoglobin at all. They're polite fish. And they run at a very slow rate indeed, but they may live centuries and we don't really know. So essentially the time scale of the smallest animal is 1 day. The time scale of the biggest animal is almost a year. And so there are whales which have roughly one meal a year. They feed for 3 or 4 months. The humpback whales that you see in Hawaii in the winter are up in the Gulf of the Bering Sea and so forth. And then they spend 8 months going around with an empty stomach, while the bat is always a few hours from starvation on roughly a daily basis and so forth.
John, question. Is the number of heartbeats per lifetime approximately a constant?
I hope not, because I've got over 2 billion now. But there are roughly things like that. They don't hold very well.
Okay. But what order of is it like a few billion per, no matter whether you're
except
one of these?
Except there are some little mammals which, which procreate like hell and have very short lives and so forth.
Shorter life, so they only have a few hundred million.
2 weeks, and they only have a few hundred million. So,
But it's within a couple of orders of magnitude.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's all a very regular world. I mean, I thought it would be utter chaos, and I'd do a little corner of it, and someone else do another corner, and so forth. And
wait a minute now, because birds like parrots and things like that have. Fairly long lifetimes.
I have that in mind.
Yeah.
Birds follow the same rules, and I've done a fair amount of work with birds, but it's hard to get them into this story without making it too difficult to grasp at once.
Everything is more complicated.
I'm a typical American. Bigness is greatness. I worked on the biggest mammal. I worked on the biggest bird, the ostrich. And One of the things you get with size is you get slowness. And slowness is the time for my brain to understand them and so forth. And an ostrich in the winter in South Africa, in the Kalahari Desert, for instance, breathes four times a minute, and you do a lot in 15 seconds. You can take gas samples all over and do all kinds of things and so forth. And birds are an entirely separate experiment. They started from reptiles with the same low oxygen, low energy budget, and on their own they found their way to the same end, and it's essentially the same value because they've got the same hemoglobin and the same diffusivity of oxygen, which is the tying point for my paper I'm giving you the abstract of here.
Okay.
Okay.
Other questions?
I've done a lot of work with diving. If anyone wants any questions on it. Uh-huh.
John could, I mean, he's trying to stay under 45 minutes. If we start opening another door, he could go for another couple hours, right? Yeah. You know what?
Well, I have a lifetime. If I haven't had 45 minutes of interest in a lifetime, for God's sake.
Yeah, for God's sake, really. We have a thing here where once a meeting, every one of these people get a three-minute rant. And that's all they get. They get one chance to speak on a topic of their choice. And I'm supposed to interrupt whatever's going on.
But I got 45 minutes.
Well, but you're different. I mean, you're an invited guest. But we have Steve Crandall, another physicist, who wants to stand up and say 3 minutes worth of stuff. So how about going for it, Steve? Here.
I'll stand here. Hang on. So I'm not going to rant. But this reminded me of something, and it actually ties into infrastructure, but I won't go there. So I know a little bit about sound and about building instrumentation, so I got roped into a project where we were instrumenting sperm whales a few years ago to listen to their echolocation.
Is this a critic hand?
What's this?
Is this a critic hand?
Well, it's associated with that. It's a different experiment. But what was interesting, so we made a little package, which was about a half meter long and about this big around. And it stuck to the whale with suction cups. And when the batteries got low, the suction cups would pop, a little wire would burn, suction cups would pop, and it would float up to the surface. And we recorded all the sound on a little SIM card like you put in your computer. So, you know, you could put in the extremely high fidelity about 10 hours of whale sound. What was interesting on the sperm whale, their snoot is about a third of their body mass, and its index matched to water. And so in sound, in the extra fraction, or water is about the same as the whale's food. They have an organ which is the same as their voice cord, that it projects, their vocal cords, but it projects back. And the back of their, where their head meets the snoot, there's a parabolic reflector, and they form this really nice, tight 10 to 15 degree beam, which no one really knew about. And as they go down, they have a really interesting pattern, which is very energy conserving for blasting this, which is loud, like it's 200 decibels. They can actually stand.
It's the loudest sound of any animal.
Yeah. So I forget.
That's what that nose is. It's a sound source. It took us 30 years to figure it out.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It was off scale.
There aren't many bright people in my field because it's obvious once you hear it.
Yeah. it's postulated that they can sense with it, which I can believe. But there was another type of whale that we look at, a little pilot whale, and it turns out the echolocation patterns from it are very almost identical to bats. And so here you have these things, the bats that we were looking at were 20 grams, not your little tiny ones, but an ounce, and this medium-sized whale we looked at was about 10,000 pounds. They had almost
both using, both finding food by sound.
Yeah, no, the sperm whale was very different, the pattern for it, but what was neat about it was the military does a lot of big sonar tests with extremely loud sonar. And as part of this, people are able to kind of be able to detect when whales are in the area. So now you can shut off this military infrastructure when whales are in the area and not stun them. It actually was causing the damage. And the Navy's actually starting to use that now. But if anybody's ever interested in echolocation of whales, I know a little bit, and I can refer you to papers, and you probably know much, much more. But it just struck me as amazing that here we have this thing that essentially has a headlight in it and really tight focus.
An acoustical headlight.
Yeah.
It's what ran the local economy, because from roughly the time of the Revolution until the Civil War, the main industry in Woods Hole was essentially whaling in the far Pacific, somewhat in the Atlantic, but mostly in the far Pacific. And The sperm whale has 5 to 10 tons of its wax. It's not oil. Yeah. You know, we call it oil, whale oil, but it's really a wax. And the only old building in town is the candle house, the stone building at the Marine Biological Lab, which is where they made the candles. And John Adams was our first ambassador in the court of St. James. And he was writing letters. Of course, they weren't very popular, having just polished off the British Army and so forth. He was writing letters to the paper. They could cut down crime on the street if they burned more sperm whale candles along the streets. He was writing Jefferson in Paris to write the same letters and so forth. Wow. All to improve local industry.
And it's index matched to seawater, better than a percent.
Mm-hmm.
It's
just amazing. Mm-hmm. And there's a great young guy whose name I can't think of right now, a student at San Diego. It turns out up in China Lake in the middle of the desert, there's a huge X-ray scanning machine for looking at the packing in rockets for NASA. And he got a sperm whale head in that and found out the whole three-dimensional structure of this sound source.
Wow. Was it Peter Tyler?
No.
Who was it?
No, he's here.
Yeah, I know.
No, I'll think of it in a minute. He was okay. One of Sam Ridgway's students or something.
Okay.
I'll think of him.
Okay.
No, it's okay. I'm just sitting here absorbing all this. It's amazing.
It is.
Well, decibels.
As I said,
scary
if,
for
if you haven't had a few things that are amazing in a lifetime, you've been pretty dull.
Yeah. No danger of that over there, I'll tell you.
Okay.
There's one other little point. You can, as they get to what the military are called target-rich areas, where there's a lot of bag clutter, that you can look at the processing time of their brains by kind of looking at the latency time between their pulses. And so as a function of how rich the target is, you can kind of measure their processing time. When they're in extremely target-rich areas, they take up to about a second to form an image. If they're in light areas, it seems to be almost video, right, like about 20 of a second.
Well,
be better with MP4.
So, John, thank you so much for being the evening.
I'm in a boathouse across the harbor writing a book on some of this, and I gave an abstract of an article I'm writing, but if you want any more,
he's got it.
I'm there.
So there we have it. Infrastructure economics from a completely different angle.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about publishing his papers? Like, there's a common practice sometimes in the research community now. There's a common practice sometimes in the research community now of when your paper gets rejected to post it up on a website that archives stuff.
Well, that's one of the things I'd like to discover because I don't have much time left.
So.
No,
and
seriously.
You can timestamp your work.
Seriously.
When it shows
up in
Nature,
you know, I have seen some amazing things in my time. One is, I can remember I was teaching at Harvard and there was a guy came up from Princeton to give a special evening lecture. And he'd been skipper of a destroyer during the war and he'd seen these flat top mountains and he's a geologist. And his theory is that planets are moving around. And there was embarrassment that anybody from a reputable university would say such a thing. But it turns out the bulge of Brazil does fit into Africa, which I used to see on the globe by my bed when I was a child and so forth. And that's where Plate Tectonics came. And one of the joys in life has been watching practice the rest of geology who disavowed this,
right,
sort of protect their reputation and so forth. So you never could be certain of these things. And in the Woods Hole in the 20s and 30s, it had been discovered that nerves, which are electrical signals, communicate chemically. Well, that's nonsense. We know there's electricity here, there's electricity here. And it took 30 years to get that even reasonably accepted.
So the scientific establishment has one of the industries that has not yet been thoroughly transformed by the internet, but yeah. It will be eventually.
Well, no. But it's a great aid.
It's a great idea.
There's instant contact to anybody in the world, which I can't quite get used to.
So, and that's publishing your papers without the closed peer review community that seems to be failing.
So what do you want to check out?
You've got to be read and it's got to register.
Yeah. That's the big problem.
Yeah, it's really
what's that?
Having me be able to Google for it will help him a lot.
I can't
even find his paper.
Yeah. I mean, there are three leading journals in this country. There's Science, Nature, and Precision National Academy. And one of them won't touch anything I have.
How many papers do you want to publish?
How many have I published?
How many you've got for us?
Well, a couple hundred, I don't know.
Okay.
We've been around a long time.
We need a list, and we got to get them scanned or digitized somehow. And we
really?
I don't, I don't even have them anymore.
Well, that won't
I retired
that.
From them.
But the point is, we, the people in this room can help you build a website, put your stuff on it, and publicize
and
the
think,
fact
yes,
that the
yes.
stuff that you've done is on the website.
And I think it's going to absolutely remake education.
Yeah.
It's got to do it. I mean, I'm good, but I'm not that good. And you know, and you only have to deal with the best when you deal with essentially the world.
Okay, one more question.
It's a comment.
A brief comment.
Well, I think what you said is quite important about how you had observed things, you had made connections, you submitted it to all the popular kind of authorities, and that it was not heard, not rejected. And I think of so many.
I've had a lot published. There were a lot of my stories out, but
right.
But the simple thing that it's not biology, that it's physics and chemistry of oxygen that makes these animals what they are. There's a basic law they're following.
I understand that. Okay. I'm thinking about the social experience of people who think differently, which is oftentimes they're rejected early on. I'm thinking that poor man who figured out that if you washed your hands after childbirth, that you would lower the rate of death. Do you know he died in an insane asylum subsequent to being completely ostracized and made a fool of by society? Or Sir Tinley, who translated the King James Version of the Bible and was rewarded for his efforts by being drawn and quartered and then burned at the stake. I mean, there is something that about that there's this real social dynamic about the kind of like the refusal to see what's right in front of you.
Leeuwenhoek saw his animalcules through a microscope 200 years before Pasteur put them together with disease. It wasn't fast. It was slow. I mean, how they could have avoided that.
So what that's about is something that I think mechanics won't
I don't know.
Help,
I can only see
something else that might.
Okay. I think that's a topic for another day. And thank you very much, John Canister. Come on. Come on. Thank you. Don't you have one more?
Whoa.
Okay. All right. Leave them wanting more. Okay, so it's birds of a feather time, I guess.